The World Trade Organization is the only international organization dealing with the global rules of trade between nations. Its main function is to ensure that trade flows as smoothly, predictably, and freely as possible. The result is a more prosperous, peaceful, and accountable economic world.
This is the beginning, and everything's at stake.
There's only one thing that the ruling interests have ever wanted, and that's everything.
What we are against.
Downtown Seattle in 1999, there was a storefront on 3rd Avenue. While all the marching and yelling and tear gassing went on outside, people in that storefront shuffled papers, hunkered over computers, and diligently watched hours of video. It was a Seattle Independent Media Center, the beginning of the network called Indie Media, and it was broadcasting the protests on air, via satellite, in print, and on the web. Indie Media showed the world what happened on the streets of Seattle. They used revolutionary open publishing software that allowed anyone to post their news to the web. They had hundreds of reporters and videographers. They told the story of Seattle to whoever would listen, and millions did. After that, Indie Media grew into a decentralized global network of media centers across countries and continents, and it's covering things that are going on right now. Stay with us this hour as we watch Indie Media go from a storefront in Seattle to the global network it is today. I'm Maggie Starr, and you're listening to A History of Indie Media. It's a story that starts in Seattle and goes all over the world. This is part of KBOO's all-day special, Whose Streets, Our Streets, on the 10th anniversary of the WTO protests in Seattle. Stay tuned. Media, the global network of independent media centers, wasn't the beginning of independent media. There have always been people willing to tell an unpopular story, and there were plenty of them running around the United States in the late 90s. Paper Tiger TV and Deep Dish TV were putting out video, people were making flyers to hand out on street corners, and Media Island was making connections in Olympia, Washington. Jimmy Madison was at Media Island at the time, and later got involved in the Seattle IMC.
It's really a pretty strong localized independent media movement going on. It was still how much that was actually reaching a broad section of the actual public is a whole other story, and I don't think it really was. You can only open up so many low-power FM radio stations and go to Kinko's so often.
So people were getting the word out into their own communities as best they could. They were talking about local happenings, uprising in Chiapas, and then more and more about the World Trade Organization and corporate globalization.
That it was just a small slice that we're really getting this alternative information, and we're saying, look, you know, this is great stuff. If more people knew, they would do something about it.
I think corporate media is essential at maintaining the view that that everything's just fine, that people shouldn't be, you know, up in arms and concerned.
Rick Fellows was at Media Island, too. And in the late 90s, a lot of people all over the world were realizing that everything was not just fine, and they were getting ready to do something about it. As the World Trade Organization made plans for its summit in Seattle, environmental activists, union members, church groups, scientists, and anarchists were making plans of their own.
All of these different things were breathing into each other and interconnected and people going back and forth.
As things started coming together leading up to the protest, though, some people started thinking about how it would play out. There would be marchers, music, people in sea turtle costumes, and who would tell the story? Who would tell the rest of the world? CNN? ABC? Media activists knew they couldn't trust the corporate media to get it right, or even to pay attention, so they decided to tell the story themselves. All sorts of causes came together for the protests to oppose the WTO, and all sorts of independent media came together to form the first independent media center. The protest was a catalyst.
The idea was like dropping a match to kindling. It just really took off.
The Seattle IMC was put together on, maybe not a shoestring, but a bunch of shoestrings. People who had equipment brought equipment. People with knowledge brought that. There was some funding from anonymous donors and in-kind donations from a few local companies. And as everyone brought something to it, the project started to take shape. At the time, activist media was called independent or alternative, sometimes interchangeably. For Seattle, though, the founders chose independent. Sherry Herndon was one of the co-founders.
I mean, it was a really clear choice that we made, and that's something that was important because we didn't want to be just a next to, an alternative to the mainstream media. We felt that if we did our job well enough, we would replace the mainstream media, that we would do a better job of actually telling the story. And if we did a better job of telling the story, we would make the old systems obsolete.
So how to do a better job of telling the people's story? Well, let them tell it themselves. Indie Media planned a full-on media onslaught, radio, video, print, and web. An Australian group called Community Activist Technology came up with code for a website with open publishing capabilities. Anyone could post to it with whatever was going on. John Duda has done tech work at several different IMCs over the years.
It's pretty simple. It's been pretty simple since the beginning, which is that you have, you know, a website, you can go to the website, you can publish news. You can publish it without a filter. It's this whole concept of open publishing, which has really been at the heart of the Indie Media Project, and is really what sets it apart, I think, both politically and technically from a lot of other radical media projects.
The Low-Income Housing Institute donated a storefront in downtown Seattle. It was quickly filled up with computers, phone lines, and tables. The storefront became the Seattle Independent Media Center, the first IMC of many to come. Once the protests got going, Jimmy Madison recalls the storefront as a hub of activity.
The audio people, the print people, all the writers, the administration of this thing, and it was basically a gathering place. And there was some video going on there, and there was interviewing. The audio people did radio constantly. They were putting it on the web, streaming it. The print people were doing it daily. They were printing up what happened and trying to print it and get it out in the street so people could kind of catch news like that. That was alternative news.
On top of all the support staff, reporters came from all over to cover the protests. They signed an anti-copyright form, releasing the rights to their work to the network. And then they hit the streets. They interviewed people, they filmed police brutality, they covered the different segments of protesters, and they put it out to the world through the website. The open publishing software worked great. The big technical problem turned out to be trying to keep the massive amount of web traffic from crashing the servers. Sherry Herndon left the IMC and got out in the middle of things, covering what was going on.
Mantras that was out in the street that morning was, you know, there were these songs that people were kind of singing, and was the whole world is watching. And we had this laptop, and I had this wireless mic, and we had this camera, and I was so aware that we were actually streaming what was happening, and it was really true that the whole world was watching.
The whole world's watching. You're listening to A History of Indie Media, a story that starts in Seattle and goes all over the world. This is part of KBOO's all-day special, Whose Streets, Our Streets. Stay tuned. The whole world was watching, in so many ways. People on the streets were getting copies of the print daily, The Blind Spot. Internet audio was being rebroadcast to low-power FM stations, and the video teams were working around the clock.
People came in from Deep Dish Satellite Network and set up a satellite link so that for each of the 5 days of the WTO, we had a fully edited half hour of video from that day to uplink around the world through satellite networks. We organized the bicycle messengers to run and grab video cassettes from photographers on the streets and shuttle them up to a house that we had devoted to video editing.
It was a two-story house that wasn't that far away up on Queen Anne Hill, and that's where the video crews would do their work. So there was like five different video crews from all over the world, mostly from the region, but we had people from all over the world in there in these five video crews, and they would work every night editing the footage from that was shot during the day.
The video teams put out a half hour of video via satellite each day with voices from the protests.
And I want to welcome, this is where you belong, right here with the labor movement.
I think it's making history and it's exciting. And it's been very exciting to see the labor movement come together and really enforce, be out there and send a message to people that we are against the WTO.
You know, it was insane that it got so violent and crazy. I mean, I'm wearing nonviolent stuff. Just, you know, I'm here for nonviolence.
Can I ask why you're writing numbers on your arm?
In case we get separated we need to contact the people we're with.
I just thought it was disgusting how undemocratic the WTO is, and I don't understand how such a small group of people can have control basically over the entire planet, and it's disgusting.
I hope that this just doesn't be a demonstration and some chaos. I hope something really real result from these demonstrations.
What is going to...
Jeff Perlstein, another IMC co-founder, saw the project grow from a dream into a fully functional media hub that provided the most widely read news on the protests. In short, it worked. They did a better job of telling the story and made the corporate media's coverage of the protests obsolete.
One thing that allowed Indie Media to gain a lot of visibility that week, with really no prior promotion or advertising, it really had just gone up days before the website, and yet it eclipsed CNN's number of hits that week, was because it allowed people to post from all over. Essentially the Indie Media reporters were scooping all these other outlets because we had essentially 300 people out on the street instead of crews that had five people out on the street. So our reportage was much more up to the minute, much more accurate in a lot of ways, and also just much more vibrant.
By scooping the big news networks, Indie Media also egged them on. CNN and ABC found themselves losing audience to a bunch of activists who were taking control of their own message. Rick Fellows is one of the people who thinks Indie Media pushed the big networks to cover the story.
I don't think they would have covered it at all if it hadn't been for Indie Media.
So corporate media did cover the protests, with a focus on property damage, but the IMC meant that there was a bar for them to be measured against. Sherry Herndon.
And if you see what happened at 2 weeks after the WTO at a town hall meeting called WTO in the Media, corporate media, did we get it right? It was packed with people and the corporate media was on trial. And it was the first time in my entire decade as an activist that I had ever seen people put the corporate media on trial like that. This is only because of the Independent Media Center that they could do it. They pointed to it time and time again. Well, wait a minute, you're saying that, but the Independent Media Center did this. That's not true. We can trust the Independent Media Center. It was incredible.
A lot of big things happened over those 5 days, and Indie Media brought the streets of Seattle to the world. But the reverse happened too. The streets of Seattle brought the world to Indie Media, And once the world found this open source, grassroots, up-to-the-minute way to get independent news, the world wanted more. Chris Burns of Los Angeles Indie Media recalls it this way.
This movement was taking shape, and I guarantee you that scared the hell out of the powers that be. And it was a very exciting time, and there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people who wanted to participate in telling the story and telling their own stories.
And indie media was a revolutionary way to tell stories. It's easy to forget that today when it seems like half of the web is made up of user-created content. But what the original IMC did with internet news was 10 years ahead of its time. It hadn't just beaten out CNN by telling better stories. It had told them in a completely new way, with a completely new model.
And now, it's everywhere. That's how revolutionary indie media was. That's really what open publishing citizen journalism launched. You look at the history of blogs, and very few of them talk about this piece. But the back end of blogs is open publishing. It means anybody can publish. And all of newspapers now, all of them who have an online presence, any corporate media, enable comments. We enabled comments to every single story in 1999. That enabled conversation. There was no conversation that was happening in media back in 1999 or 2000 or 2001 or 2002.
And the excitement wasn't just over the code or the technology either. It was about what the code made possible. As Chris Burns says, people were thinking big.
What we were thinking was, how do you take advantage of this technology to develop a massive grassroots network, you know, that was decentralized but had the ability to come together at moments for solidarity, for direct actions, for communications, for logistics, for infrastructure like servers, etc. So we knew that there was a potential here to develop something that may not have been developed in this way before.
This was a network unlike any before, but that doesn't mean that no one had ever thought about the possibilities. There were ideas floating around. In the mid and late 90s, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation was gathering support for its revolutionary movement in Chiapas, Mexico. Support for the movement came from all over the world, including from some activists in the United States. Jimmy Madison.
People that were paying attention to social justice and social change and political happening and awareness were definitely watching what was going on in Mexico with Marcos's writing.
Marcos, more commonly known as Subcomandante Marcos, is the spokesperson for the Zapatista movement. A lot of people were paying attention to him because the Zapatistas were, and continue to be, revolutionary revolutionaries. They've used the internet to spread their ideas widely and gather international support. Marcos's words travel around the world. He even made a video announcement to an activist conference in New York in 97 called Freeing the Media. He said, "We have called for the creation of a network of independent media, a network of information. We mean a network to resist the power of the lie that sells us this war that we call the Fourth World War." That's what Marcos calls neoliberalism and corporate globalization. He said, "We need this network not only as a tool for our social movements, but for our lives. This is a project of life, of humanity, humanity which has a right to critical and truthful information." So, ideas about independent media were in the air, and there was an awareness of the revolutionary potential a network of that media could have. And U.S. activists weren't the only ones paying attention to the Zapatistas. Chris Burns.
The RAND Corporation was very sensitive to the Zapatista uprising. In fact, they wrote all these sort of papers called Social Net War. What they were very concerned about, and in their language, was that the internet allowed for the ability for people to create what are called all-channel networks that allow people to swarm together using information very quickly. They were concerned about the power of the state in relation to the power of these sort of networked groups that would come together at vital moments to challenge state power. And there's many examples of this, actually, in during the struggle in Chiapas in the 90s.
We'll be right back. You're listening to a special day of KBOO programming, Whose Streets, Our Streets, on the 10th anniversary of the WTO demonstrations in Seattle. This hour, we're looking at the history of indie media, the grassroots media network that got its start in Seattle and spread all over the world. Stay with us. Success of indie media in Seattle, with all these ideas in the air, activists wanted to put up IMCs at more protests. Chris Burns.
A number of people were very excited about, you know, what we could do with this kind of organization, you know, grassroots, decentralized, direct, participatory, democratic structures. And there was an excitement in the sense that everybody wanted to create their own IMC, and there was a lot of events that were happening. People were going back to their localities or hometowns or whatever, and they needed to get started.
I mean, it was explosive. It was explosive. We had no idea. We really weren't prepared for that. We were basically caught up in a tidal wave.
Sherry Herndon's comparison to a tidal wave isn't that far-fetched. There were dozens of new IMCs springing up all over the world, and folks from Seattle helped support them. A lot of organizing went on by email on listservs, and tech teams traveled around to help new centers get running. Indie media achieved a growth rate that any corporation would envy. But have I mentioned that indie media has always been entirely staffed by volunteers?
What indie media did with nothing, with a shoestring budget, was absolutely some of its brilliance. It had nothing to do with money. It had to do with resourcefulness. It had to do with collective resourcefulness.
Indie media was expanding really fast. To use another naturalistic metaphor, you could say it went viral. And like any virus that travels fast enough in a lot of different directions, it started to mutate.
A lot of IMCs were starting to show up that had connections to the state or had connections to political parties. And in one case, I recall in Russia, there was a situation that was sort of a right-wing, you know, version of an IMC was happening. And I can speak for myself, but I know a lot of other people felt this way too, that this was going to be a problem.
So they had a meeting and invited as many people as possible. It was in San Francisco in April of 2001, and nearly 100 people came from all over the U.S. and all over the world. They didn't want to lay out too many rules, but between listserv discussions and hashing out language at the meeting, they came up with principles of unity and a criteria for membership. They've been revised since then, of course, but they're still around. To join the network, a new IMC has to agree to the criteria for membership. That keeps any of them from being affiliated with a specific political party, for example, or from trying to be for-profit. And it requires all IMCs to have open meetings and editorial policies. The meeting helped hammer out guidelines for indie media, but a lot of things have worked themselves out along the way.
I don't think it was ever the case that somebody was like, we need to have a global tech infrastructure. It just kind of emerged as a process, you know, sharing experiences, sharing strategies.
So IMCs were going up at protests, and then after the protests ended, they were sticking around to cover day-to-day events. And then, of course, the big protests got a lot harder to organize and fewer and further between after 9/11.
9/11, it really derailed the anti-corporate globalization movement. But, of course, indie media kept going, and there was a lot of communities that kept going and kept doing media and telling the stories and being involved in activism. But definitely not in the same way pre-9/11.
So let's cut to now and here in Portland, Oregon, where one of the 178 independent media centers in the global network is alive and well. Quite alive and well, actually. Volunteers told me that the Portland website is the third most visited in the global indie media network, behind Brazil and Italy. So what kind of news do you find at portland.indiemedia.org? Let's take a look. Okay, the top features are about the state killing sea lions at the Bonneville Dam. Looks like Animal Defense Media posted a video for that one. Some activists staged a silent protest at a Portland school board meeting against military recruiting in schools. There's an announcement about a big protest next weekend. Then over on the side, there's all the latest stuff from the Open Publishing Newswire. let's see, a story about how the Vancouver Winter Olympics are on stolen native land. There is a communique from Students for Animal Liberation, something about activists assassinated in Venezuela, and a call for people to start their own indie media online radio shows. Hey, just for comparison, let's check out the Portland Tribune's website. Let's see. All right. Top story is about E. coli in a local reservoir, then a body found in the river, a murder-suicide, and the Ducks-Beavers football game. So you can kind of see. Indie media does things differently, and they get different results. It's different news. It's 10 years to the day since Seattle, and still, members of the Portland IMC say that the decentralized, independent media space that started there is crucial to social change. Wendy B. is a Portland indie media volunteer.
It's become very important to me personally that we have the ability in our own communities to tell our own stories. That becomes our weapon. It's not just independent media as a tool of information, it's a tactic to preserve the people's history. And I feel personally that we have been lied to, misrepresented for so long that it becomes so important to have an opportunity to be able to tell the story from the people's viewpoint.
We've seen the model that they've given us and it doesn't work. It's all based on what they want us to hear. And indie media is that re-envisionment of democratized media. It's media from people to other people in their community.
Ashes is another volunteer at the local IMC. He's done radio trainings, event promotion, and editorial work. But like the other volunteers, he doesn't let the day-to-day tasks obscure his vision of the new model he's part of. Maybe open publishing isn't anything different these days. It's just as easy to post to a blog as it is to post to indie media. But the folks at Portland IMC, and at all the IMCs, are working to make possible something that's still very radical. People telling their own stories.
Everybody is responsible for if something happens to you or something is important is going on that you are getting out there and reporting it yourself in your own words directly. Nobody else should be speaking for you.
That's Victory. She's another Portland volunteer. The way she puts it, you can see how everyone has a responsibility in this indie media model. But she also knows that with that responsibility comes control. If you speak for yourself, no one can misrepresent you. And as an activist who's been around Portland since before indie media, she knows how nice that is.
It didn't used to be like that. You know, you used to have to be very media savvy, and you had to be really careful how you worded your press release, and even then, you know, only tiny little snippets that didn't really represent your view very well would make it into the media, and most of the time it would be spun unfavorably. So it's very important that we keep democracy in the media and keep that open access. And it's definitely a lot cheaper than, you know, buying your own printing press, for example, or paying a printer. With this, like, anybody can do this.
Now that Victory is an indie media volunteer, she's not so much getting the word out as making it possible for people to get the word out.
I think one of the biggest misconceptions as far as people seeing the site for the first time, and their assumption right off the bat is, oh, this is all driven by volunteers, and those are the people who are writing articles. When volunteers for indie media, all we do is try to enable content for folks. We try to give that outlet.
Volunteers at Portland Indie Media maintain servers and equipment. They take down spam that gets posted to the webpage. They pick out stories to be featured on the site.
It actually takes a lot more volunteers than people realize, I think.
Victory has been around indie media long enough to see the numbers of volunteers rise and fall. People move in and out of town, get and lose jobs, and move on to other commitments. So is Wendy.
I fear sometimes that folks believe that it's run magically by people who don't have other jobs and other lives. It's just not true.
The Portland IMC is looking for more volunteers to show up at its general meetings right now to help them run things. Like all IMC websites, the Portland site is based on the same open publishing idea that started in Seattle. That sounds like it should make running a site easy, right? People just post their stories and you watch them go up. But in fact, volunteers have to be on the watch for spam and junk that gets posted, and they also implement the site's editorial policy. You can't advocate criminal activity on Portland Indie Media, or homophobia, racism, or sexism. You also can't repost corporate media articles or obvious slander or libel. But if you post something and it gets taken down, or if you see an article you don't like, that's not the end of the story. Here's Wendy.
This is the people's media. It is what you make it. So if people, I feel, if people have things that they're contesting or questions that they have about anything from editorial policies and guidelines to content mandation or whatever, they should come to the meetings. We have open meetings every Saturday at the Red and Black Cafe here in Portland at 5 p.m. and they are open. Come with your questions, your comments. We'll be more than happy to address those.
The Portland IMC is autonomous, but it's one autonomous IMC in a network of many. IMCs help each other out and share resources when necessary. Portland, in fact, lent a helping hand to the Twin Cities during the 2008 Republican National Convention.
When the Republican National Convention happened in the Twin Cities, we had the opportunity to help them out with some radio work because their radio facilities had been raided and they just weren't set up to handle a lot of stuff at that point because of the different raids and attacks that had gone on. And so Portland was able to go on the air for them and take call in from the streets, you know, in the Twin Cities area and report what was going on right then and there for them.
Wendy was also at the RNC. She traveled out from Portland to cover the protests there. Ever since Seattle, covering big protests has been indie media's bread and butter. They get a lot of people on the ground with cameras and recorders, and they're able to document clashes with the police as well as report what's going on. Since Seattle, though, it also seems like the police have gotten a lot more used to large protests and more used to indie media's presence. Here's Wendy.
It was pretty apparent by the arrest numbers at the RNC 08, which I was one of the arrestees, that out of the 800 and some odd almost 900 of the total arrestees, one out of every eight or nine was independent media. And as we see on the front lines, you can now see the police pointing two cameras, two people identifying as any kind of independent media as targets to be watched, profiled, pepper sprayed, and arrested. And out of all of the independent media journalists and producers that were arrested during the RNC 08, nearly all of us had our charges dropped just long enough to be able to remove us from different actions and from actually documenting what was going on, just long enough to keep us detained so that we wouldn't be able to get the information out there.
That's part of a trend that Chris Burns has also noticed when indie media covers protests.
They know the power of a video camera. They know the power of eyewitnesses. They know the power of media. They know the power of the internet, which will get this information out there in seconds. These days, before the event actually happens, they come and raid you, take your equipment, and arrest you, and then deal with the consequences later. The repression is going to get a lot worse as the stakes get a lot higher.
You're listening to a special day of KBOO programming, Whose Streets Are Streets, for the 10th anniversary of the WTO protests in Seattle, Washington in 1999. This hour, we're looking at the history of indie media, the global media network that started in Seattle and is still covering the world today. Stay tuned. Police repression at protests goes after individual indie media reporters, but indie media has also seen law enforcement go after its hardware. Most recently, the United States indie media beat a subpoena of all traffic to its servers over a 24-hour period, and that certainly wasn't indie media's first legal battle. The first big one was in 2004 at the Free Trade Area of the Americas demonstration in Quebec. Kind of a long story, but someone broke into a car, and the car turned out to belong to an undercover police officer who had infiltrated some of the protesters' networks. So the guy who broke into the car rifles through it, finds some files, figures out the undercover infiltration thing, and wants to make it public. Sherry Herndon will take it from here.
The irony was they had infiltrated us. Someone, like, broke into this unmarked car, took these files. We're like, wow, look at these files. This is really interesting. Let's go upload them to indie media. So sure enough, they did. The government came knocking at the door of 1415 Third Avenue, saying, because that was the address for the server where everything was being, because we only had one server back then. Now we have lots of servers. But they tried to take us down then. They tried to shut down the servers. And fortunately, there were people like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which continues to do incredible work. So was our lawyer, still is our lawyer, as well as the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR. So we won that case because the government backed down, because we had the top legal minds in the country.
What the government wanted, both in that case and in the recent one against Indie Media US, was IP addresses and other identifying information about everyone who accessed their server during a certain length of time. So Indie Media does some things differently now. It doesn't log IP addresses the way most websites do, for one thing. That way, even if one of the subpoenas ever stood up in court, indie media wouldn't have any information to hand over. And outside of the US, there are sometimes different legal requirements. Then the tech volunteers get creative. John Duda.
Of course, it varies from country to country. Some countries have much stronger regulations on data retention. So in some countries, it's illegal not to keep IP addresses. And we've worked, that's one of the advantages of having this global network, is that we're able to sort of dedicate resources where they're going to be useful. So there's a kind of solidarity going on where, say, indie media sites for one country will be hosted in another country where the legal jurisdiction is different, making it harder for the, you know, making it possible to get around things like data retention policies, but also to make it possible for servers to be in a totally different jurisdiction from, say, the law enforcement agencies that might be interested in the content on them.
Even though indie media has always come out on top in legal battles, they try to play it safe because they've learned that the government doesn't always play fair. Sasha Costanza-Chak is a longtime participant in indie media, and he also studies new media and social movements at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications.
You know, those in power will always find any way that they can to silence voices of dissent. It's just become increasingly difficult for them in the age of the net. But it's far from impossible. So they'll physically come in and stop reporting. They'll take cameras and break them. They'll seize computers and they'll seize servers.
Indie media can definitely anticipate continuing skirmishes with law enforcement. There are other challenges too. For one thing, remember how I said when open publishing came out at the WTO protests that it was 10 years ahead of its time? Well, it's 10 years later. There's a lot of open publishing out there.
People have come to expect a lot more out of the web than they were expecting in, say, 1999, when even the fact of being able to easily post up a picture online to go along with, you know, a piece of news content that you had generated was, you know, in some ways something that people had, you know, maybe not even seen before. And now this is very commonplace. You know, you have 1,001 ways to share photos online. You know, you can post video online very easily, which consequently sets indie media at a disadvantage because people are expecting things to, you know, more and more to just work or to be faster or to, you know, have more reliability. And I think it's hard for a very loosely coordinated all-volunteer network to maintain that level of, you know, expected service. I think it's something that people forget when they're like, well, this indie media site isn't working as well as, say, YouTube. Well, that's because YouTube is, you know, funded by billions of dollars of Google money.
For a lot of younger folks, I mean, there's no reason necessarily to post specifically to your local IMC when you've already got your own YouTube channel and Twitter feed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Facebook, Flickr, MySpace, YouTube, Twitter. It seems like they've all jumped on the indie media open publishing bandwagon, right? Speak for yourself. Post photos to go with it. Right? But John Duda reminds us that those companies have their own priorities.
That rush towards user-generated content is really about monetizing it, about finding out how to make people work for free for you, how to collect information on people, sell that to advertisers, use the content that people are producing to basically satisfy your venture capital funding, and then, you know, be, you know, able to have an IPO or to be bought out by some large corporation.
So if you're a radical activist looking for a place to post something, that's actually pretty important. Indie media is not profit motivated, and they don't log IP addresses because they don't need to tell their advertisers how many hits they're getting. And that means they won't sell you out.
So it's one of the few places where you can be assured that your information that's being posted, your news story that you're creating, is actually being done in a way that will protect you legally.
There are challenges that indie media faces off the web, too. It's a simple fact that not everyone has access to the internet.
The work of indie media becomes, in a way, the more difficult work of doing the grassroots organizing and outreach to communities that aren't already sort of have always-on connectivity.
So there's a lot of organizing to do moving forward. But indie media is a strong network with a lot of strong nodes and a lot of strong people.
We're not just a techno-centric, you know, organization. We just use technology, but we're a social activist organization. You know, that is the way I see us. We are just taking advantage of technology, and that's something that, you know, we absolutely need going forward. You know, we're activists, we're reporters, and we're social creatures who recognize that solidarity is the key to any action and any movement.
Media looked for a term to lump together all the different protesters in Seattle. What they came up with was anti-globalization. That would make indie media the information hub of the anti-globalization movement. But if you've been listening, you know how funny that is. Indie media is all about globalization. It's about people the world over sharing their stories and their experiences with each other. It's about erasing the distance between people marching on the streets of Pittsburgh and a woman at an internet cafe in Delhi. It is about globalization, like the WTO, and it's about user-created content, like MySpace, and it's about news, like CNN. But it's not a company, not an organization. It's a network, and it's not for profit, not for business, not for the government. It's for the people, by the people, telling the people's story since November 30th, 1999. Thanks for joining me this hour. I'm Maggie Starr, and this History of Indie Media is part of KBOO's all-day special, Whose Streets Are Streets. On the 10th anniversary of the battle in Seattle, we're looking back and forward. Stay with us until 8 tonight for more of this exciting programming. I'd like to thank all of the people I talked to who helped me produce this history. I played audio from the five-part series Showdown in Seattle, produced in Seattle during the protests in 99. It was originally produced for Deep Dish TV by Seattle Independent Media Center, Big Noise Films, Changing America, Free Speech TV, Headwaters Action Video Collective, Paper Tiger TV, Whispered Media, Video Active, and scores of other media activists. Thanks also to Jenga Soderberg. You're listening to KBOO. Stay tuned.
four winds, seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me. Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know, 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world will our children receive after all is said and done? What kind of creed have we come to believe that they may never receive one? What kind of world will our children receive after all is said and done? What kind of creed must we come to believe if they are ever to receive one? Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me.
Thanks for listening to Whose Streets, Our Streets, KBOO's all-day special on the 10th anniversary of the Seattle WTO protests. As part of the program today, we're hearing from people who were there. KBOO programmer Chris Andre was at the protests. This is her story.
Well, I run a farm, so it's very hard to get away to do anything. And finally, towards the end of the week, when the determination was really peaking, I thought, this is it, I'm going. So I locked it up and unfortunately had to bring my dog, Vita, with me. And we headed for Seattle. We got there and it was astonishing. Where I was parked, the streets were virtually empty, but you could see the helicopters, you could see smoke, tear gas. It looked like we were heading into a war zone. And I walked through it. And then later on Friday, I guess the next day, I joined the labor protest when they were marching. There was a great deal, and of course at the jail, when all the people who had been arrested were inside, and demonstrators went out to the jail, and we knew they could hear us. I mean, everyone was chanting together. It was really beautiful. But interesting thing, and organizers now, today, who were there at the WTO 10 years ago in Seattle, we speak and we plan, we talk strategy and we talk tactics as though nothing really had changed. And yet everything has changed. We now, many of these people in Seattle who were brave and courageous and faced police violence, faced incarceration, now would be looking at terrorism charges. And I think that the whole atmosphere around activism, industrial sabotage, tactics which in the past had been used in some cases in an ill-advised way and in other cases had been used in a strategic manner, now are off the table entirely because of the atmosphere of fear that has been created. And, of course, the way that mainstream media now is so dominated by reactionary forces, throwbacks to the Puritan days, where witch hunts were a routine response to anyone who stepped out of line. And we're in those days right now. We're in the thick of it. We're in deep, right up to our eyes. But at least our eyes are still okay. Our eyes are still open. We see what's going on. But I think we are in a hiatus right now, holding patterns that we're trying to decide how to confront these this juggernaut that we face that's right currently fueled by fear, armed with fear. It's proved to be enormously effective. There's very little, it's very hard to fight against that, especially when the threat is real. As anyone, one of my guests on there, Cascadia Robsonic with the RNC8 in Minneapolis, could tell you, when animal activists, teenagers, high school kids, are charged with terrorism for trying to protect animals, you know we've really crossed the line. And we're Thomas Pynchon would say in Gravity's Rainbow, we've gone transmarginal.
That was KBOO programmer Chris Andre sharing her memory of the WTO protests.